Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Civil Rights and Supervisor Liability Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 24, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Vance v. Ball State University. This case involves Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, a federal anti-discrimination law, and revisits the circumstances under which an employer may be held liable for harassment by its supervisory employees. If the alleged harasser had the authority to direct and oversee the work of the plaintiff, but did not actually have the power to terminate her employment or discipline her formally, can the employer nevertheless be held vicariously liable for the alleged harasser's misdeeds? In an opinion delivered by Justice Alito, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that an employee is a supervisor for purposes of vicarious liability under Title VII only if he or she is empowered by the employer to take tangible employment actions against the victim. Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, joined the opinion of the court. Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion. Justice Ginsburg filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. To discuss the case, we have Jason Schwartz, who is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Schwartz.
Good afternoon. We're going to discuss briefly the Supreme Court's decision in Vance versus Ball State University. Vance answers a question about the law of workplace harassment that was left open by the two key 1998 decisions, Farragher and Ellerth. The Farragher-Ellerth duo are well known for establishing rules around when the employer is liable for workplace harassment. Under Farragher and Ellerth, there are basically two different frameworks depending upon whether the alleged harasser is a quote-unquote supervisor or not. If the harasser is not a supervisor, if that person is merely a coworker, then the standard for whether the employer is liable for that person's harassment is whether the employer has been negligent, essentially whether the employer knew or should have known about the workplace harassment and did not take adequate measures to prevent or mitigate it. On the other hand, under Farragher and Ellerth, if the alleged harasser is a supervisor, then the default assumption is that the employer is going to be vicariously liable for what the supervisor has done. That if you have vested this person with authority over other employees and that authority has assisted them in the harassment, well, then the employer is going to be responsible for that. And there are basically two subsets of that rule, if you will. The first is, if in furtherance of the harassment, the supervisor has actually taken some tangible employment action, hiring, firing, demotion, some other change of status against the victim, well, then there's strict liability because they've used the authority of the employer in order to further the harassment, and so the employer is liable. If, on the other hand, the person is a supervisor who's done the harassing, they're aided in their ability to harass the employee by their authority over that person, but they haven't actually taken an official employment action, then the assumption is that the employer is going to be vicariously liable, but the employer has an affirmative defense, the so-called Farragher-Ellerth defense. And that is, if the employer can show that it has taken reasonable care to prevent or correct harassing behavior, and that the employee who was the victim unreasonably failed to take advantage of this opportunity. In other words, they could have prevented or mitigated the harm if they had come to the employer to complain, but they didn't do so. Well, then that insulates the employer from liability. So that whole framework has existed for 15 years now, very familiar to folks who practice in this area. Again, negligence on the one hand and a form of vicarious liability with an affirmative defense on the other if the harasser is a supervisor. But at the beginning of this conversation, I alluded to this current case, Vance, addressing an open question. The open question was, well, who is a supervisor, so that we can figure out which side of this line a case falls on, which set of rules to apply. And essentially two options or two tests had grown up. One was a test that was promulgated by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and that was kind of a multi-factor, you know it when you see it test, that the supervisor is not only someone who possesses the authority over hiring, firing, discipline, other changes of status, but also someone who has some amount of significant authority over day-to-day working assignments, conditions, schedules, and so forth. That was the EEOC's test. And then some courts took a stricter view, and that was only if you have that authority over hiring, firing, changes of status, does that make you a supervisor. So more of a black and white type of strict rule. This particular case involves a woman named Mayetta Vance, who was employed as a catering assistant at Ball State University. She's an African-American woman, and she alleged that she was subjected to a racially hostile work environment by another catering worker, someone who appeared to be at least slightly further up the food chain in the hierarchy there at Ball State, catering specialist, a white female named Sandra Davis. And the employer, Ball State, argued, well, we're not liable for Sandra Davis's conduct because Sandra Davis is not a supervisor, so we're not subject to the stricter vicarious liability standards. And as a coworker, we would only be liable for what Sandra Davis allegedly did if we were negligent, if we knew or should have known and didn't take appropriate measures. And Ball State argued, and everyone appears to have accepted in the courts below, that it did take appropriate measures to negate liability under a negligence standard if this were the coworker. The district court and the Court of Appeals in the Seventh Circuit both said, well, the test that we're going to apply here is this bright line test, not the EEOC test, but the bright line, did Sandra Davis have authority to hire, fire, promote, demote, make other employment actions? And the answer was no. And therefore, it's only a negligence standard, not a supervisor standard we're going to apply here. And again, the courts found that Ball State was not negligent. So this comes up to the Supreme Court, and the key question to be decided again is, well, how do we figure out who is a supervisor so we can decide which side of the Farragher-Ellerth line a particular case falls on? The majority opinion, which is authored by Justice Alito, in which the Chief Justice and Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas join, adopts the bright line approach. So the court, noting the benefits of an easy-to-apply test, which can be ascertainable in advance to govern conduct, and which in many cases will be able to be decided on the pleadings or shortly thereafter on the basis of written evidence, on some kind of dispositive motion, and even if it need, can go to the jury with simple, easy-to-apply instructions, is the test that the court adopts. And it points to all of those benefits and articulates the test as a supervisor being only an individual who has the authority to take tangible employment actions or to make recommendations for tangible employment actions, hiring, firing, and other changes of status. So this is may sound familiar. It's a very parallel standard to what we would use under the Fair Labor Standards Act to figure out who is an exempt executive, someone with the authority over these sorts of tangible employment actions. The court rejects the alternative test that was proposed by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. It evaluates that guidance from the EEOC under the Skidmore standard, where it only gives deference to the extent that the agency's position has the power to persuade, and the majority concludes that the agency's position does not have the power to persuade because it creates a test that is too vague and ambiguous and difficult to apply, particularly in a modern workplace setting where you may have teams and projects where one coworker might direct the day-to-day activities of another with respect to one part of the project where he or she has the lead, and someone else might be in charge of a different part. And it would be very difficult to tell in a given case who is a supervisor and who isn't. The court decides that's too open-ended, too vague, and so adopts the supervisor test that had been articulated by the Seventh Circuit, this bright line test. Couple key takeaways from that. The bright line test ought to be relatively easy to apply, but the majority opinion does go through a number of scenarios that are unclear, if the person makes recommendations but doesn't make the final decision, if the person has authority over significant material changes in responsibility that might have economic consequences, that's a scenario where they might be deemed a supervisor. But it makes the important point that without any suggestion of that type of authority, the individual, although not a supervisor, it doesn't mean that the employer is off scot-free. And it makes the further observation, the majority opinion, that in evaluating whether the employer has been negligent in preventing or remedying coworker harassment, one of the relevant factors is the amount of authority that the coworker had. So even if not a supervisor, the court suggests that someone who has authority to direct day-to-day activities might subject the employer to a heightened standard of negligence as opposed to a coworker without such authority. So it leaves open those questions for another day. Couple of important practical points that I think are worth focusing on in the decision. There's an important discussion at page 28 of this negligence standard, and it identifies, the majority opinion identifies some questions that could be asked of an employer to figure out whether it was negligent. For example, if the employer did not monitor the workplace, that would be evidence that suggests negligence. If the employer failed to respond to complaints, that would also be evidence of negligence. And if the employer failed to provide a system for making complaints or effectively discouraged complaints from being filed, those things would also be relevant to a negligence finding. So again, it really just reinforces, I think, what we've all known and practiced with since Farragher-Ellerth, and that is that an employer is best positioned both to create a positive workplace and to defend itself against these kinds of claims by establishing a robust policy, robust training, and a robust complaint mechanism to address as early as possible these kinds of workplace concerns before they get out of hand, to prevent these kinds of issues or to mitigate and remedy them if they've started to percolate. So I think that is all reinforced by the majority opinion. The dissent, authored by Justice Ginsburg and joined by Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, advocates for the EEOC's more flexible approach to who is a supervisor, goes through a variety of cases, and suggests that in those scenarios, without the rule proposed by the dissent and the EEOC, there wouldn't be liability, although, as the majority points out, that's not clearly the case at all, because there still is the negligence standard that would be out there to address those situations. And then finally, the dissent concludes by inviting Congress to act to overturn this decision. So I think it's a fascinating read. It underscores yet again the preference of the court for bright line, easy to apply rules and standards, for rules that help employers understand their responsibilities prospectively and that help courts and juries to dispose of cases in an unambiguous and clear way, while at the same time promoting a culture of compliance and effective policies and complaint mechanisms. So on the whole, I think it's a very positive decision, sets up clear expectations for employers and clear rules to apply. Let me make one final observation that I think is worth keeping in mind as employers litigate these cases, and that is there may be a rush in certain cases now to argue, if someone's been accused of harassment, that individual was not a supervisor under Vance versus Ball State, and therefore that the vicarious liability standards do not apply. But I think it's important to keep in mind the employer's overall organization when you do that. For example, if this is a frontline manager where you're already arguing or perhaps anticipate the need to argue in an FLSA case, Fair Labor Standards Act case, that the person is an exempt executive and has authority to hire, fire, make changes of status, or make recommendations about those things, well, you certainly don't want to be saying the reverse in a harassment case. And so I think it's important to have a good understanding in advance of which employees you would concede are supervisors and which ones you wouldn't. There's also a really interesting discussion in the majority opinion about the test for supervisor under the National Labor Relations Act, that is those people who are not eligible to be members of a bargaining unit with their subordinates. And while that test is not exactly the same, it is similar. And again, I think the overall employee and labor relations strategy ought to be kept in mind before you make arguments about who is or who is not a supervisor under these rules. So thanks very much for taking the time to listen, and I hope that this was a helpful overview for you of the Vance versus Ball State decision.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.